Hi, today is May 31st, 2015, and this is Mobile Views Podcast number 118. I'm Taro Gasawara with my good friend John Westfall, and today we're mostly going to talk about what was announced at Google I.O., if I can wake John up, because I don't think he was really excited by what he saw and heard.
It was an awesome venue. I mean, did you see the wraparound screens? And
no, I didn't actually watch. I just read about it.
Well, you know, they went to some great lengths to have some very nice production values on it, but the actual content was a little bit less than exciting.
Well, not excited.
So Android M is, by their own admission, a focus on the UI and make the UI better sort of release. It's not supposed to target the moon and the stars like Lollipop did. It's supposed to be kind of a, you know, let's get some things right. And in that end, they did some nice things. They overhauled the volume controls, which were a point of soreness for many Android users using stock Android. And they changed a few things around. They changed the app drawer from being a horizontal slider, which I absolutely despised, back to being a vertical slider, which now people are absolutely despising because they got used to the horizontal. And, you know, they added some cool stuff. We can kind of go down the list of things. But really, none of this is the, oh my God, I have to go get a new Android device to be able to run M when it comes out.
Now, that is kind of interesting. Now, there's good things and bad things about it, right? So the good thing is they are focusing on areas that are not exciting to the end user, but are much needed in terms of improvement and fixing and stabilizing and other things.
Well, there are two of those that I can kind of talk about that I know you hadn't noticed. They're the developer things that I put down. So here's two good examples of things that they did that make perfect sense developer-wise and are going to enrich the UI, but they're not going to do it tomorrow, and they're not going to make users are not going to notice them.
Okay.
The first is verified links.
Okay.
Verified links is a way for an app to claim a domain as anything that is in this domain is my, you should send to my app. So for example, the example they gave was Twitter. The Twitter app can say anything at twitter.com is my area. You should always send that to my app and not to the browser. And the way it's done is through basically the reason it's verified is because the operating system goes out to twitter.com, looks for a signed key that says, yeah, this is the same as the app's key. And then when you get an email that has, say, a Twitter.com address in it, someone says, hey, look at this tweet, it was really funny. Mm-hmm. When you tap on it, instead of it bringing up the disambiguation screen, which is that, okay, what do you want to open this with screen, it just takes you directly to Twitter's app, which is a nice thing in that it's one less step for the user. It hopefully provides a better experience for the user because they're going straight to the best app to display the content. But it's not something users think about very often.
Right.
The other thing is custom Chrome custom tabs. Developers have always been able to instantiate a web view in their apps and load web content in an app versus having to go out to the Chrome browser. Now, the problem with that was when you opened up a web view, you had to build kind of a rudimentary web browser. You didn't get access to saved passwords or autofill-in data, all that stuff. So what Chrome Custom Tabs lets you do is, as a developer, skin a custom Chrome tab, take out some of the stuff, add a button. So they showed an example with Pinterest saying, look, when you tap on this thing, it loads up the full web page. Mm. But it's a Pinterest-themed tab in that it's got a pin it button at the top, and you can add things to the overflow menu and that sort of thing. Again, this is something that users will really like because it'll enrich the UI. But it's not something that's going to show up on a TV commercial, and it's probably not even something users are going to notice changed with Android M. They're just going to, 10 years from now, take it for granted and go, you mean we haven't had that all the time?
Yeah, so basically Android, I think, has become mature enough that most of the stuff that we want, that end users want, is already there, and now they have to make it nicer and better, faster, more stable. You've kind of reached the point where iOS was a couple years ago, where although iOS keeps adding interesting features every year somehow, For the most part, it's not really that different from, I won't say the initial launch, but the second year, the Apple 3G era, where apps became available, because the first year apps weren't available. So, you know, the UI is pretty much still the same. There have been some significant additions, like, you know, notifications and the ability to send data to other apps, like from Safari, you can bookmark or save a web page to Evernote, that kind of thing. But for the most part, end users will say, well, isn't it supposed to do that? And not really think of it as something cool.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe Android, they haven't said what M stands for. M might just stand for mature.
Well, I know you had your preference, and I you know, I've heard marshmallow and M&Ms, but, you know, being Japanese-American, I'd rather go with manju, which is a Japanese pastry that I really like. So I'm
going to... a quarter Italian, I'm going with meatball.
Okay, which a quarter Italians, I assume, is a dessert.
No time is a bad time for meatballs.
Okay, I agree with that. Okay, next up is something that's... okay, my notes, I said Google Pay was Google Wallet, but that's not really true. So Google Wallet still exists, but now it's got like a B2B thing, right?
Yeah, Android Pay is basically taking the mobile payment infrastructure that's been around on Android for a while now, that was always kind of tied in with Google Wallet, the NFC payment system, and making it more visible, basically. You know, Android Pay, it's not a surprise that they chose that name to be very similar to another payment processing architecture.
Microsoft Pay? No.
Yes. Windows Pay.
Windows Pay.
That'll be next year. But, yeah, Android Pay is... taking some functionality that Android users have enjoyed for a while and just, I think, bringing it out to show a lot of the users that haven't noticed it before that, hey, you can do this with Android too.
Yeah. Now, next up is something called Now on Tap, which I believe is an enhancement to the existing Google Now, which if you are invested in the Google ecosystem, Google Now on Android, and actually it's also available through the Google app on iOS, and more limited function on the web. I think very few people use Google Now on the web, although you get notifications and things. Basically looks at what you're doing and tells you about things you want. And Now on Tap is supposed to extend that to kind of like Cortana-like features, I think. Or it's supposed to guess what you're trying to, what you might need to know.
If you always thought that Google Now was spying on you, now it really is. Now on Tap is the contextual search ability that Google Now will have, so that if you're in a text message, for example, and you write, hey, do you want to go out to Hey Joe's for dinner?
Yeah.
You can double tap, and it will bring up information. Go, hey, you talk about this restaurant named Hey Joe's, and here's some information about it, and that sort of deal. So it's actually actively looking at the current content. It doesn't have to be content that's previously been stored. It can scan it at the moment of tap and figure these things out. Or I guess it's doing some prefetching probably in the background as well.
Yeah.
That's another thing I worry about with Android. There's an awful lot of talk about prefetching content, and iOS does this too, but for people who are on limited data connections, I worry about doing a lot of prefetching. But.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I share 3 gigabytes a month with my daughter, and who's home for the summer. And... boy, I tell you, she's been using a lot of data. I've had to remind her, hey, hop on Wi-Fi when you can. okay, so next up is something I think the one thing that we both really liked as end users, and that's Google Photos, which is separated from Google Plus, kind of, sort of. There are a couple of things that weren't separated, but I'm writing an article for Extreme Tech that should be out this week. So I'm going to save some of the what the heck kind of moments I found. But I will say this. I was really excited because it does provide, it has two levels that you can choose from. You can either choose full resolution up to, you know, whatever, but you're limited to, I think, 15 gigabytes unless you pay for more over and above Google Drive. Or you can choose to have unlimited photo storage if you allow Google to compress photos that are greater than 16 megabits, recorded, taken at 16 megabit resolution, and you allow them to compress video that is more than 1080p.
So this is something that I think makes perfect sense for Google to jump in on. It's the same thing that Apple and Amazon have been doing. I just think about it in terms of, in about 5 years, I've been taking digital photos for around 16 years now. Mm-hmm. And in about 5 years, I realize I'm going to hit critical mass when it comes to how do I deal with all these things. I've already gotten to the point where my photo library takes up a huge chunk of my hard drive. I have backup hard drives of it and all of that. So it makes perfect sense for Amazon and Apple and Google to all jump into this space to say, hey, you're going to have these digital photos that you want to keep forever. Let us manage them.
Yeah. And as an aside, and I'm going to talk about this more in the article because, and I still don't really know the end game is, I started, Google Photos was announced on the 28th, which I think was Thursday. And I downloaded it right away, but I didn't start uploading my photos till Friday morning. I have been uploading photos from my old iPhone 5 and my current iPhone 6 Plus. It's a little over 7,500 photos, that's 7,500 photos. It's still uploading. I started my iPhone 6 Plus, which had fewer photos. I think it's like 2,500 photos. It's got 87 left. But I'll talk more about what I think is happening. I think it's basically just server overload with everybody trying to upload their photos at once. But it's really slowed down since the initial relatively fast start on Friday morning. And I still think I have 1,700 photos left to upload from the iPhone 5, which I started uploading from yesterday. And I should know this is all over Wi-Fi, of course. I'm not doing anything over LTE or cell data kind of stuff.
Yeah, my plan with Google Photos is to wait a couple of weeks and then fire it up on my home server and let it kind of go to town with my image archive. Because I tried to do that with Amazon, and the Amazon app on macOS was just so horribly buggy that it never uploaded more than maybe a sixth of my photo libraries. Mm. So I'm hoping Google does a little bit better of a job.
Yeah. And, one of the interesting aspects of it is not just, of course, having storage, but the fact that Google Photo, and I have an S here in our notes, Google Photo, no S, on the web does some pretty interesting stuff, kind of like Flickr announced a couple of weeks ago, where it does, it categorizes your image. So, if you have a dog or a cat or a bird or scenery or rainbows and boats and all kinds of trees, all kinds of stuff it categorizes. So it categorizes your photos for you, faces, of course, which it did previously, but in Picasa. But it's got some problems. We've got some pet rabbits that have been variously identified as dogs and cats and I think a boat. And one bird. Yeah, I think it identified one of them as a bird at one point. So it's got, it's a work in progress. Image recognition is not as easy as one would think it might be. And certainly, even people make mistakes when they're looking at something. They think they're seeing one thing and it turns out to be in reality something else. So we'll see how it improves over time. I'm sure the more photos we feed it, and maybe if they give us some way to give them feedback, like, no, this is a chair. It's really not a boat. That sort of thing, I think, would be useful.
I'm pretty sure you're just trying to cover up the fact that your rabbits can fly. That's why I categorize them as birds.
And also bark and meow.
Yeah, all of that.
Yeah.
Rabbits are very versatile.
You should see what your birds are characterized as. They might be characterized as rabbits too, but
check that out.
But at any rate, I've got about 5,000 or 6,000 photos uploaded now to it. It also had a bunch of photos uploaded through Google Plus and Picasa earlier, so it's an interesting process so far. Okay, next up is something. It's one of kind of those old things with a new name and new hardware, and that's Jump. I should call it the Jump Camera, so I'm going to type that in to our little show notes. So Jump Camera is, I think, something that Google is partnering up with GoPro on, where you have this. Okay, first let me say this. If you guys remember Google Glass and how dorky people said it looked if you wore one. I never got one, by the way, because I simply couldn't afford the $1,500 for something I wasn't sure I wanted. But wait till you get a load of Jump Camera, because Jump Camera is 16 cameras arranged in a circle that I assume you wear on your head. And it looks like a crown of cameras, of GoPros, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is allows you to take virtual reality photos, you know, in 360 degrees, right? Like the Google Street Car, where you can drives down.
Have your own Google Street View.
Right.
You can be Google House View.
Right. So, you know, I assume it doesn't have a LiDAR, so it doesn't do, like, distance recognition and things, or distance estimation and things. But it's pretty funky looking. I'll see if I can, I'll snap a screenshot and post it under part of our blog and with a link to Google or Jump. And, you know, they're saying that this brings the possibility of allowing the masses to record 360 degree virtual reality videos, but honestly, this is for like one step beyond an enthusiast. Mm. Because first, you got to buy essentially something that has 16 GoPro cameras, and you know that's not going to be cheap. And second, you got to wear this thing on your head or some reasonable. Well, yeah, if you don't wear it on your head, you're going to be in every 360 photo, right?
And you have to also lose all of your self-respect.
Well, yeah, and for those of us who don't have any, yeah. It's okay, but yeah, if you have self-respect, this could be a challenge to wear in public. And good luck trying to go through an airport with this thing on.
I mean, that would be the interesting thing about it. You're trying to get a virtual reality image of how it is to go through a public place, but yet everyone is turning and staring at you.
Right. Right.
So,
and security is coming up to you constantly. Yeah,
it's going
to
be like the
guns
your
drawn.
Worst nightmare, you know, your worst nightmare, not really what your trip was actually like.
Right. Yeah, the worst case I think would be wearing this thing would be I want to do a personal documentary of traveling from A to B, you know, so, through an airport. And so you wear this thing, you go through the airport, of course you got to take it off to go through TSA, you put it back, then your fellow passengers and your airplane are looking at you, and of course you're looking at them because you've got a 360 device on.
Yes, you are staring at all of your fellow passengers.
Yeah, simultaneously. And then, of course, you know, deplaning and going through baggage, and goodness knows what the bomb sniffing dogs will think of you as they see you.
Okay. Well. We'll see, Google. We'll see how this one works out.
Yeah, I'm really hopeful, you know, because I love virtual reality stuff. I'm really a big fan of Google Streets, Google Street View, and you know, I can't get enough of it. I just wonder who is going to actually, who among my friends, shall we say, John, is going to buy one, wear one, and use it. I think you should do it for your research.
I might be passing on this one.
I don't know.
You might have to bite the bullet and buy something expensive this time.
I don't know. I think there's a grant opportunity with this guy. This But I think it's something for you. Okay. The next one, you know, I really didn't read too much about, and that's basically the Android Wear improvements. But I'm really...
Because basically there was nothing to read about it. The improvements are very evolutionary, not revolutionary. So things like keeping the screen on but in low power in situations where you don't want it to be blinking off.
Yeah.
And more reliability and things like that. But it really was nothing that stood out to me as a game changer in the wearables.
Okay. That, you know, I was hoping that they would announce some new next generation watches, because I did not buy an Apple Watch, and I am still looking for something to replace my Microsoft Smartwatch, my Sun 2.
You know, you want a Moto 360, just go out and buy it.
You know, Costco had a Moto 360 for I think it was like $150 or so a couple weeks ago. It's gone now, and I considered it because, you know, I really think despite the shellacking it took for that little cutout on the bottom because it's not a full circle, I never thought that was a huge problem personally. You know, just from a, like, oh my gosh, you know, my watch is broken. No, I'm not going to think that. But I did, you know, I know that the next Moto 360 version 2 is going to be coming out soon. So, instead of spending $150 on last year's technology, I might as well wait for a couple months. And I hope this Google I.O. was going to be when some announcements were made, but I don't think I saw any for new watches. So I'm going to wait a little while.
I guarantee you, I think Apple will be announcing a lot more in terms of watch improvements at WWDC than Google did at Android Wear at Google I.O., which is kind of discouraging.
Yeah.
Of course, one would say that some of the things that Apple's rumored to announce, Google already allows on Android Wear. So, in a sense, Apple is playing catch-up on a few things.
Yeah, custom watch faces and apps and things like that. Oh, I should mention, I saw the original Pebble at Sam's Club for like $97 or $98. So, you know, that was another thought, but I said, eh, I'll just wait for a new Moto 360.
All right. Well, at least you have a plan. I'm confident that you will carry that.
The plan is to wait. Which is like the worst plan in technology, but oh well. Okay. So next up is something that actually doesn't sound exciting, but is really useful, and that's Google Maps offline directions. Now, you might think, hey, I've always been able to save, you know, a chunk of my Google Maps to my local store for when I'm out of data reach. But the fact is that does work. You know, you can save the map so when you're driving along, the GPS still works, and you can see where you are, but you can't get directions because you need data for that. So Google Maps offline directions lets you continue to get, you know, turning directions and so forth when you are off the wireless grid, so to speak, when you don't have 3G, 4G data. And I think, you know, for folks who do travel in, you know, off the beaten path, that's quite useful. So I'm looking forward to that. I rarely travel off the beaten path, but, you know, there are times when I've been kind of off of cell data for one reason or another. You know, kind of in between or spotty coverage or whatever. So I'm looking forward to that. I think that'd be very useful, especially if you're lost somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Many years ago, I bought Copilot, which is one of the third-party GPSs, because it's only $10.
Yeah.
And at least at the time it was. I think they run sales. They're usually $20, but sometimes you can get them for $10. And that's what I've always had, kind of loaded on the device just in case. You know, I like using Google or Apple Maps, but I, you know, have Copilot there just for some of the GPS-like functionality it gives me. So it's always nice to have that offline backup just in case.
Hmm. Do you remember who makes Copilot? Because that sounds real familiar. It was like, well, wasn't question. Tom? It was, oh gosh, wasn't Garmin? Delorme? No.
Maybe no, it wasn't Delorme. ALK.
Oh, I'm not even familiar with that one.
ALK is, they've been around for a few years now, and Copilot's there, and basically it's on Android and iOS mapping navigation. And it's very affordable, much more affordable at the time when I bought it than some of the other things that you could do with it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and next and last and, well, I won't say least, but is something called Project Brillo. I'm reading off the webpage now, and it says Brillo, because all I got from it was kind of as an Internet of Things thing, and that's what the description says. This is Project Brillo. Brillo extends the Android platform to all your connected devices so they are easy to set up and work seamlessly with each other and your smartphone. Internet of Things isn't a big deal. Microsoft announced Windows 10 IoT. So this kind of sounds like this, except instead of being Chrome OS based, it's, you know, their major platform, which is Android. So, as a developer, are you looking forward to this? You going to try it out?
I may. I'm curious to see what exactly it will allow. So I'm kind of watching and waiting on this.
Yeah.
That being said, it really is dangerous to watch and wait. I just started playing with yesterday in Xcode core data, which was introduced in iOS 7, and I'm absolutely amazed at how useful it is. So you really shouldn't wait too long on some of these things. You know, 2 years, it's probably too long.
So this one is going to, you know, it's Android-based, and so it lets your phone talk to other devices, including the Nest and the Nest ecosystem. And it can work with other manufacturers' devices too, third parties, outside of what Google owns. So it'll be interesting to see.
Really xenophobic. I don't want my phone talking to my other devices. I want to separate and conquer. You know? Otherwise, Skynet is close to reality.
I think it's already there, but I mean, you know, there's Google Loon and the Google Boston Scientific killer robots and all those kind of things. So I think we're there.
And we have the audacity to complain about Google I.O. not being interesting enough.
Yeah, but they didn't announce any of that at Google I.O., right? None of that was discussed.
No, but I'm looking out my window to see if there's a drone out there waiting to blast me after, you know.
No, you'll never see it coming. It'll be a balloon, you know, high in the sky out of your view. And, you know, chemical laser or whatever the state of the art is these days. Which reminds me, Terminator Genesis is going to open soon, but this is not a movie review. Okay, so that's all from Google I.O. that I remember. It wasn't exciting to me at all. Maybe I missed something.
But we'll see. And our next, the next time that we're able to podcast, we'll talk about Apple's WWDC so we can kind of compare and contrast. I don't know what we're going to see at WWDC this year, but I worry it might be another one of these yawn type things too. But we'll see.
The things I'm looking forward to, even though I don't have an Apple Watch, is I'd like to see custom watch faces and apps announced at WWDC for the next gen Apple Watch, or the next version of whatever watch OS. What is the OS in the watch called, by the way? Is it Watch OS?
It's just Watch OS, yeah.
Just Watch OS, okay. So I'm looking for that. The other thing I'm really looking forward to is the rumored split screen in iOS 9 for the iPad Pro. I'm not sure it's going to be available for the other iPads, although I don't see why not. But a split screen would be really useful because I know there's a lot of times where I've got a web browser and I've got, say, Evernote up and I'm taking notes on something I'm doing research on. It'd be really nice if I didn't have to flip apps to, you know, read something and type something and all that sort of thing, which is, you know, how you work on a desktop. So,
all right. Well, hopefully Google will or Apple will come through and we will be able to talk about that. There is one bit of Apple Watch news that I can share that I found interesting this week. So about 2 weeks ago, Apple released a update for Watch OS. It became 1.0.1 instead of just 1.0. Mm-hmm. And some users were looking at their heart rate data, which was saved in HealthKit, and saying, it doesn't look like it's recording as regularly. You know, it used to be every 10 minutes or so there was a new heartbeat data recorded. Right. So there was some suspicion that maybe there was a bug in 1.0.1. Apple has at least put it out there now, and I'm not sure if this is through official or unofficial channels, that the actual reason why it's not recording your heart rate every 10 minutes is that every 10 minutes it checks to see if your arm is moving. And if your arm is moving, it figures you're in motion, and it wouldn't be a very good idea to record resting heart rate. Mm. So it skips that recording and then waits another 10 minutes. And if your arm is not moving, if the watch is more or less stationary, that's when it's taking its readings now. Hmm. So according to Apple, this is just a smarter version to get a better accurate resting heart rate, not something to be worried about, but I think it would have been nice if they would have put that in the release notes, because the release notes for 1.0.1 simply read bug fixes. So we had no idea what was going on, but that is the official line, or I guess unofficial line, about why your heart rate data is not as verbose as before.
Yeah. I wonder what they consider arm movement. I mean, is it literally the swing of the arm while you're walking, or is it, something more subtle? And I'm thinking about people who might have tremors, or, you know, if you've ever stopped drinking coffee like I did years ago. After being a 5-cup-a-day person many, many years ago, I stopped drinking coffee because I don't actually enjoy it. I actually used to drink it because I had to get up early in the morning to go to work and then stay awake. So then I just, after I changed jobs where I could get up a little later, I stopped drinking coffee, and I wondered why my hand was kind of trembling for a couple of weeks after, you know, when the caffeine withdrawal kicked in.
Well, we have no idea how exactly it is, but it is somewhere on the continuum between Todd's caffeination jitters and Kermit the Frog's wild flailing of arms.
Okay.
So somewhere in there is where their cutoff is.
All right. And next, you had a question for both of us, I guess.
Yeah, you know, since we there wasn't that much to talk about with Google I.O., my question was, what's one thing from another platform or device that you have almost willingly dropped your platform or gone for? So while you're thinking of yours, I'll talk about mine. And that is, right now, my primary platform, as it's been for a couple of years, has been iOS plus OS X. So I live pretty much in the Apple ecosystem all the time. My previous ecosystem was kind of a mix of OS X and Android, and then before that it was Android and Windows, and then before that it was Windows Mobile and Windows. So I've done these platform shifts a few times, but there's pretty high bar for every time you do it because you have to change things around.
Right.
But I will tell you that the idea of the all-in-one tablet plus laptop plus stylus plus slimness of the Surface Pro 3 has tempted me more than a few times in the last couple of years. Starting with the original Surface Pro, but now with the Surface Pro 3, it's, you know, there's always this little lurking mind of mine that's like, you know, if I sold all my Apple gear, I'd have a lot of money and I could buy a really nice Surface Pro 3 and really trick it out.
So, now, I noticed you didn't say Surface 3, so you is it a bigger screen that much of a draw compared to the Surface 3, which is kind of sort of, you know, similar.
Well, I would
not quite
I
as fast.
I would want to see the I would want the increased performance, and I would also want to see it as a laptop replacement. So that would be it. But there, in the end, I'm pretty heavily invested in my platform right now, so I don't see myself going kind of schizophrenic anytime soon and jumping ship and disorganizing everything to reorganize it in another way. But that is something I think about from time to time. Of, you know, what would get me to switch? Because that is obviously something that tech companies are very interested in knowing. And what would get you to switch from your current situation to another. So what tempts you, Todd?
Well, I won't tell you what tempted me because I'll tell you what actually switched me. And that is I used to be like you, you know, almost all Apple. And I have to admit, I mean, right now I'm using a MacBook Air to do this podcast with you. But for the most of the time these days, I am sitting on Windows if I have a notebook or a desktop. Actually, I never use a desktop anymore, but if I have a notebook running. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Reason number one is you can get a lot more stuff for your money if you buy Windows compared to Mac. You know, more storage, more RAM, that sort of thing. As an example, when my Dell notebook died about in March, I think, I had to go buy another Windows machine. And my MacBooks are still running, so I didn't have to replace those. And which says something, by the way, because I bought the MacBooks before the Dell, and the Dell broke first. But the new Dell I bought, let's see, it has 12 gigabytes of RAM and a terabyte of hard drive. Not an SSD, but, you know, a terabyte of hard drive and a touch screen or an 8.1. I think I paid $650 for it. There is no MacBook you can buy for $650, and the you know next up would be about $900,000 for a MacBook something, and it won't touch those specs. But that said, the other thing is that the Dell had touch, and you know honestly, touch on Windows is not that spectacular, but there are those you know that 1 or 2% of the times when you reach out to your screen, and I do this, I've done this for years. Even though I knew my Windows and MacBooks don't have a touchscreen, I still touch the darn screen every now and then, except now it actually does something. You know, if I hit a button, touch a button, or I gesture to zoom in on something in a web browser, which you can do without gestures. You can do it from a keyboard to zoom in on a web browser to make the fonts bigger, that sort of thing. But it's just a little bit easier for those few times when I go and put a fingerprint on my screen and have something happen versus nothing happen, which is the case for OS X right now. On the mobile side, the truly mobile, the phone tablet side, I would say I use iOS and iPhone or iPad 90% of the time, and I do have Android tablets and phone. Well, I have an old Nexus 4, which I do use. It's my Nexus 4 is actually my primary voice phone. Not sure what it would take to get me to switch completely to Android. For one thing, something doesn't crash as often. Something gets updated more often. And there are a few apps that still aren't there on Android that I would really need. I'm trying to think what I really would need that's not an Android. What I certainly want is Civilization Revolution. One of my favorite games is not available on Android as far as I can tell. There was an open source version, FreeCiv, but it was not nearly as good.
It is, on a related note, it is interesting to me how in the Apple App Store for OS X, there are a lot of games now from the late 90s, early 2000s that are appealing to nostalgia buffs like myself. So SimCity 4, Roller Coaster Tycoon 3, The Sims 2. I actually bought The Sims 2 last week, and I've been playing around with that. And it is really interesting how... Sometimes, I guess it is, the older you get, the more you just want what you played with as a kid. You don't really like the newfangled stuff, but Apple is cashing in on that market, and those publishers are cashing in on that market as well.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the Maxis stuff, which I think was... Wasn't Maxis just shut down by EA not too long ago? But in any case, you know, SimCity was one of my all-time favorite games. I would say it was probably, if I had to name... two games that were my favorite all-time games, it'd be SimCity, the original, or maybe SimCity 2, and Sid Meier's Civilization. And it really doesn't matter which version. They're all pretty good, you know, first couple, two, three versions. But The Sims, which I bought but never really got into. I remember when I bought it and I was fussing with it, and it really didn't appeal that much to me. I was thinking, you know, if I could carry this around like a Tamagotchi, you know, it'd be much more interesting, right? Because then you could interact with it when you're standing in line at a bank or, you know, whatever other waiting you do, standing in front of an elevator or something. And I wonder if that's what appeals to you now on the, you know, having it on the phone versus, you know, having to go to a desktop to play with it.
Well, it's interesting. The Sims that I bought was for the desktop, so it's on my laptop. But my wife plays The Sims Freestyle or Free Time or Free something or another. I forget the exact name of it, but it's a real-time version of The Sims. Mm. You start them doing something, and then you have to come back a few hours later, and then you pick them up and do something else with them. And but that runs on the iPad, and so that's been her... kind of go to. It's a freemium model game, but she hasn't ever bought anything in it. She's just kind of played it for a couple years now. So the other night we were just amused because whatever quest she was on had the Grim Reaper hanging around the house, and the Grim Reaper decided to cook a steak on the grill. And we just thought that was really funny that the Grim Reaper would be grilling, you know, in his free time waiting for something else to happen.
And, you know, that's interesting because that model sounds a lot like the old Tamagotchi design, you know, where you basically, you do one or two things and then it leaves you alone for a couple hours, but it's got just enough rewards to draw you back in a couple hours later and, you know, peck at the display or buttons or whatever it is, the device you're running it on. And then you go away, and then, oh, I got to go check my, you know, my thing again. Shoot, I didn't play Farmville, but there was another game I was playing, something Cities. I can't remember, but it was very addictive. It was very addictive.
Yeah, I just couldn't get into Farmville because I don't like farming that much. My best quote about Farmville that I ever ran across was someone had wrote, do you want to enjoy farming without all the benefits? And play Farmville.
Yeah, I forget what it was called, Wii City or something City. Anyway, you build cities from, you know, kind of like, it's not kind of like SimCity. It had some of the elements of SimCity, but it was really more like Farmville in terms of everything else, where it was the, you know, kind of repeat addictive thing. And if you really got drawn into it, you paid for stuff. I never did. But in any case...
It's just interesting how we still, you know, look back at older stuff or the let me just plan out my world sort of thing as being something we continually get drawn back to versus the, you know, latest and greatest VR first-person shooter sort of thing.
Right, right. Okay, so as we come to an end of this podcast, I am happy to report that after, let's see, Friday morning, so after a little over 48 hours of uploading, almost all the photos from my iPhone 6 Plus are uploaded to Google Photo. And it's really weird because it started off really fast. I thought it would be done by Friday night. But it's been really fits and starts
when it uploads.
Oh, say that again,
John. I'm happy to report that now about... I'm happy to report that now about 40% of all the rabbit photos that Google stores are from you.
That's right. Thousands of them, literally. Mm-hmm. Right. Also, lots of rainbows. It also categorizes rainbows, so I might show a few of those. I do have a triple rainbow photo, which is kind of fun.
Triple rainbow. What does it mean?
Three rainbows, one on top of the other. Yeah. Yeah.
That's not as good as double rainbow, but we'll take
And I did not jump up and down when I saw it. In fact, I didn't even notice the third one until I saw it in the photo because it was so faint. But in any case, this was Mobile Views Podcast number 118. It was scintillating, exciting. No, not really. Because Google I.O. was not scintillating or exciting to John or me. There were a couple. Like I said, Google Photo. That is pretty cool. Jump camera. I want to see somebody wearing it just so I can YouTube it and, you know, make fun of the person.
They'll see you doing it, though.
They will see all, but maybe not know all. Okay, 118 is in the can. We'll talk to you next.